Okay, well, first off, I suppose, is where can people find your work, your website, your newsletters, your Twitter, all the rest of it?
Well, of course, the one-stop shop for everything I do is CorbettReport.com. That's CORBETT report.com. And from there, you can find my YouTube channel. You can find FukushimaUpdate.com. You can find my work on Boiling Frogs Post, the International Forecaster, Global Research TV, and anywhere else I might happen to be posting things. But it's all available there at CorbettReport.com.
You do get about, don't you?
I do.
We were wondering what time you got up in the morning.
Generally speaking, I wake up with my son, so somewhere around 6:30 or 7. But actually, just between you and me and anyone who may happen to be listening, I've recently started a New Year's resolution to get up 3 times a week and do some jogging, because I'm reaching that age where I'm starting to feel the effects of having done no physical exercise for a very long time. So I'm trying to do better.
Yeah, I know that feeling well. I haven't quite taken it to the extreme of jogging yet, but...
It is an extreme, trust me. But but actually, you know what? I know this sounds ridiculous, but it actually feels good. It feels better than just trying to get as much sleep as possible and just sitting there in bed and then feeling horrible about all that time you wasted. So,
well, it's all about endorphins and stuff.
Yeah.
And releasing them. And I've heard it's good for the soul. It's good for the mind. It's good for everything else. But I'm not quite there yet. Right. Cracking on then. As this is a New Year's Eve or a New Year's interview, and with the amount of knowledge that you have in all sorts of areas, it would be okay if we start on a whistle stop tour of the world hotspots at the moment.
Let's do it.
Okay. What about what's happening in America at the moment? I mean, it just seems as though it was set up to fail, like a 200-year experiment or something. What are your views on that?
Well, I suppose that's one way of framing it. I'm not sure it was ever set up to succeed particularly. I mean, I guess it depends. We could be very amorphous about this, but there were specific people who each had their own specific agenda and things to bring to the table. I think there were people involved in the creation of the United States who had their own reasons for doing so and truly did believe in sort of the Enlightenment rhetoric. And then there were others who I think were cynically using it. And then I think there was also a longer term game plan to use the new world to create a new world order. And I think that was part of the game plan from the beginning as well. So I think you've got a mixture of that. And I, in my podcast, have talked to some degree about some of these founding fathers and their contributions. But I was delighted to discover in a recent edition of the Peace Revolution podcast the fact that it was in fact not Thomas Jefferson who wrote the Declaration of Independence, which has always been a bit of a head scratcher for people who realized that he kept slaves throughout his life to the end of his life. And in his dying will, he allowed some of his more developed slaves, I guess, to be free from his bondage. But it was kind of bizarre that someone who could pen such a beautiful statement to human freedom and liberty would keep slaves all of his life. But I was delighted to discover in that recent edition of the Peace Revolution podcast, it was not Thomas Jefferson who wrote the Declaration of Independence, as every history book will tell you. It was, in fact, Thomas Paine, who was, in fact, very much dedicated to the abolition of slavery, who, in fact, advocated very hard for a clause in the Constitution to abolish slavery, which of course would not have been accepted by a lot of the states at that time, the various colonies. So his authorship has been lost to the ages, but there's quite a convincing argument to be made. Anyway, so I think someone like a Thomas Paine was truly interested in that idea of human freedom and what could be brought about in the creation of a new government. But then you have the well, people like Thomas Jefferson, who did have some good ideas and was on the right track, I think. But then you have other people like George Washington, an admitted Freemason, who ended up embroiled in the Whiskey Rebellion just a few years after the creation of the country. So, I mean, I think there was obviously whatever ideals of human freedom and liberty that the United States was supposed to embody was quickly shown to be more or less a political fraud perpetrated by a certain political class that just wanted to maintain and expand its power over the rest of the citizenry. What else is new? I mean, I think that's just the way that everything happens. And then, of course, you have the Alexander Hamiltons and others who literally wanted George Washington to be a king and wanted a kingship instituted in the U.S. and wanted the central bank and all of that. So clearly someone who was just acting in the interests of the British crown, really, who wanted just to transplant that power over to the United States. So you have a great mixture of people involved in it. And I think there was... from the beginning, there were people involved in the creation of the country who were very much interested in seeing what it's become now, which, of course, right now is, just this sort of monstrosity. And I don't put that on the American people. I've met many Americans in my lifetime, and not a single one of which that I've met in actual real life, as a real human being, has been a particularly horrible person. It's just that I think that their government has absolutely been taken over and used as an instrument of power for the perpetual ruling oligarchy. And that's the stage that we're at. And I think that there is absolutely going to be a takedown of that Pax Americana, the American system, the American world order that we've seen for the past century or so, is going to be taken down in the next few decades anyway. I couldn't place a particular time frame on that, but it's certainly happening as we speak, and it's really just a question of those trends extending outwards. And I think that's all part of the plan, because of course if you do want to set up a world government or a world tyranny, how else are you going to do it other than taking down the current world power? So I think that's going to happen economically, financially, politically, and militarily.
Well, this is a mantra I've been saying for a long time, is that you can't have a one world government, a one world currency, a one world anything with current governments and currencies existing independently at the moment. They have to all be taken down, including the police and everything along that goes along with it. So moving on, Putin, big subject at the moment. What is the real story? What do you make of the sort of cuddly Shay narrative that we're being fed about Putin? Do you see a more nefarious background to that?
Well, I wouldn't trust anyone who is a high-ranking KGB official or FSB official farther than I could throw him. And I think it's kind of sickening in my mind that there is a certain section of the alternative media that holds him up and venerates him as if he's some sort of savior for this new world order rather than just a participant in it. And I recognize the fact that there are... I recently did a podcast about China and the new world order and the linkages between the Chinese ruling oligarchy and the Anglo-American, Israeli, Western, NATO ruling oligarchy. And I think those linkages are pretty clear. I don't think it's quite so simplistic in the Russian case. I think that there is some degree to which Putin and his St. Petersburg cronies are something of a bulwark against some of the oligarchs in Russia, but that doesn't make them the good guys in this narrative. I think it's too simplistic to fall into that trap. And I understand why people get caught up in that, because it's always nice to have some sort of idea that there's some sort of political savior that's going to come down from on high to save the poor people of the world and, is going to act as some wonderful bulwark against all of this stuff that we see going on. But I think that's not really the case. Again, Putin's just a strong man of his own sort, and he has some interesting linkages with Henry Kissinger, for example, who he often dines with and meets with, and who's apparently on friendly relations with, friendly enough that apparently, it's just been revealed that the Obama administration has been quietly trying to do some backdoor sort of hidden diplomacy with Russia that they were attempting to engineer through Henry Kissinger. And it hasn't been confirmed whether or not that took place. But apparently they were reaching out to Henry to get in touch with his old friend Vladimir so that they could do some sort of some diplomacy on the hush hush. So, again, I think that fits into this overall narrative of all of these ruling oligarchs are in one way or another supportive of this aim of global government. And it's just a question of what that global government is going to look like rather than whether it should exist. And of course, Putin has been very much championing his Eurasian Economic Union, which has been explicitly and admittedly modeled on the European Union with a council and all of the court and all of that again has been modeled specifically on the European Union model. So it's not that he's offering a fundamental difference to the globalist oligarchs. It's just that he wants a sort of Moscow centered one, or more Moscow centered one. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, that's right. And like you say, the connections with the KGB and everything just can't be overlooked. And let's face it, wherever Kissinger goes, the trouble soon follows behind. He seems to be more for a multipolar New World Order than his unipolar New World Order. But at the end of the day, it's still a New World Order, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of ridiculous when you think of Henry Kissinger as being some sort of spokesman for American foreign policy. I mean, why are there so many of these foreigners who are so high ranking in the American foreign policy circuit who are supposedly advocating for American interests? I mean, it's just, yeah. I mean, on its face, it's ridiculous.
Are there any Americans for American policy at all? It just seems, yeah, crazy. Well, you covered the China sort of question there, the relationship between China and the US, unless you want to expand on that. I know you put a good article together recently calling them frenemies, which, yeah, seems about right. But it's not what we're being told in the media, is it?
No, unfortunately, again, I think it's being simplified into either people believe the mainstream narrative, in which it's just a rivalry that's going to end in some sort of warfare or something, or there's the alternative take, which is basically that BRICS and China again are going to be some sort of saviors, and they care about the people of the earth, which again I think is baloney. The ruling oligarchs of China care as much about the Chinese as the ruling oligarchs of any other country care about their fellow countrymen, as if that really means anything in this day and age anyway. So again, yes, people can check out my China and the New World Order podcast or my U.S. and China Frenemies with Benefits article to get some more on that.
Yeah, it's very good. Moving closer to home, into back down to the UK, what's the significance that you see now with the City of London's link to the yuan, the new exchange they've just opened up?
It is significant on sort of global scale, but I wouldn't say that it's significant in particular between the City of London and Beijing. It's just another place where yuan are now being directly exchanged, including Frankfurt and I believe some places in South America. Australia recently signed an agreement, so it's not unique. I think it's just part of the overall system that's being set up, where the yuan is gradually being made into a convertible currency, which is obviously going to be one of the planks that's needed for the yuan to become a competitor on the world stage, and perhaps part of the IMF special drawing rights basket, which apparently that review is going to be taking place later this year, and it might be added to that basket. For people who don't know, the special drawing rights are basically just a reserve currency that are held by central banks that are redeemable in pounds or euros or dollars or yen. But every 5 years, the IMF decides, you know, whether or not to add it or subtract any currencies from that basket. And this year, they are contemplating whether to add the yuan to that basket. 5 years ago, they decided not to because of such things as the yuan is not a convertible currency and it's not widely enough used in international trade, etc. And that has all very much changed dramatically in the past 5 years. So I think this is all just part of, again, situating the yuan to become more a player at that global table. And some people speculate, well, maybe, you know, they're going to start a new BRICS currency and it's going to be gold backed and all of this. Again, I'll believe it when I see it. I think that this is really more about angling to try to get the yuan just as part of the system that already exists. And this is in line with the current round of reform ideas that are taking place right now. There's been a reform package on the table for governance reform of the IMF for several years now that would give players like China a bigger seat at that table. And China's been advocating for that. And I think that this is also a ploy to try to get, again, just a seat at that table when it comes to special drawing rights. So I think it's just part of the weaving in of the Chinese economy into this global economic order.
Yeah, I think it's all part of the plan, really, isn't it? But moving closer to your home, Japan, what is the future for Abe at this moment and his economics? I've heard talks that even though he won recently, he's going to be forced to stand down. Does that sound about right?
It should be, given the fact that Japanese politicians tend to last a year, if that. Abe's already lasted two, so that's well beyond the usual mandate. So I'd be surprised if he makes it to the end of his 4 years, which he theoretically has, given his latest election victory. If you can even really call it that, it was the lowest electoral turnout, voter turnout, in the history of modern Japan since the Second World War. And also, there were numerous districts where they did not even run an opposition candidate, or not from the main opposition party, because this was a snap election and they just didn't have time to organize. So I think it was a political sort of move, a stunt that Abe did in order to basically secure an electoral victory, precisely because I don't think he'll be able to secure another electoral victory. As the absolute dismal, ridiculous failure of Abenomics becomes more and more apparent to everyone, with this has been based on the idea that this is going to revivify the Japanese economy and is going to get the corporate sector going again. That's been a complete fraud, as we see from the collapse of GDP figures last year, but also from the greatest collapse of real wages in the world, actually, in the 21st century. Japan's real wage decline is just continues, and when you plot real wage growth versus GDP growth, you see that the GDP growth that has been accomplished in the past few years, to the extent that it has been at all, has been a complete fraud, and it's been based on the devaluation of the yen. So we've seen basically the yen being inflated away into nothing. We see the USD JPY chart plotted against the Nikkei 225 chart, and it's in absolute lockstep. Every time the yen loses value against the US dollar, the Nikkei goes up. So it's no surprise what they're attempting to do, and that even that's not working, as the USD JPY is not falling any further, and they're having a hard time even inflating their currency away into nothing. So Abenomics has been a complete failure. There's no way to go from here. I mean, all the Bank of Japan can do is continue trying to print money till the cows come home. But of course, Japan is facing the demographic winter of a declining population. And last year, for example, record number of deaths and record low number of births. So it's pretty obvious which way this is all heading. There's really no out for Japan unless they start taking in more immigration, more skilled workers, and if they massive reforms to the economy, which of course just aren't going to happen in a society that's as steadfast and set in its ways as Japan is. So I think it's really a crisis point. I would be surprised if Japan even manages to maintain its third largest economy in the world ranking for very long, as I think we're just on the downward slope of a very, very long, perhaps gentle, but still long downward slope down the economic ladder.
Well, it seems to be quite a common theme around the world of voter turnout going through the floor. It's been the same here in the UK, and obviously our economic policy is being told that we're in recovery when it's quite clear to anyone with half a brain that we're far from recovering from anything. But interesting to hear that the Japanese are also. Do you think they're getting the turnout reflects their state of what they think of voting politics these days?
To a certain extent, yes, and especially here in the Japanese context, where the current ruling party has been in power for almost the entirety of the post-World War II era of Japanese modern democracy. And that changed in 2009 when the main opposition party actually came into power. And of course, with all of the type of rhetoric that you would expect of a main opposition party coming into power, and perhaps on something, I don't know if it was directly related, but something of the sort of euphoria of Obama coming in and hope and change. I think we saw something of that in 2009 when the main opposition party came into power here, but they ended up doing pretty horribly, not much really changed. Some of their main talking points were immediately backed off of. The removal of the U.S. military base from Okinawa, for example, was immediately taken off the table. And all of these things that they had been promising when they were out of power, suddenly they weren't promising when they were in power. So, and that just ended up in some scandals, and eventually they were kicked out, and the traditional ruling party came back into power. And I think after that point, I mean, I could understand there's just a lot of voter apathy at this point. I mean, not a lot of people are particularly happy with Abe in the way that his administration has been going. But really, what's the alternative? And I think a lot of people are seeing that. So I think that explains to at least some extent the lack of voter turnout in the last election.
Well, that sort of concludes our whistle-stop tour around the world. But in terms of what is the alternative, that sort of brings us on nicely to our next question. With so many people scared of the word anarchy and the word libertarian for some reason, take us through what you think an anarchistic society would look like.
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think you're right to identify that people have been trained to be scared of words like anarchy and even libertarian to some extent. And certainly, I mean, there are certain historical reasons for that. I think anarchism has been associated in, certainly was in the late 19th, early 20th century. It was associated with bomb-wielding terrorists who were interested in political assassinations and the like. And, of course, historically, anarchism has been very much a sort of socialist tradition, as opposed to state socialism advocated by the Marxists. It was more of a stateless socialism advocated by going back to Proudhon and then down through some of the Russians, Kropotkin and others. So that's sort of the tradition of anarchism. And as I say, it was very firmly in the minds, embedded in the minds of people in the early 20th century that anarchism equals terrorism. So I think that's where sort of that idea of anarchy is just this state of chaos really came into the public imagination. And ever since then, I think that's the way that people have been just sort of through osmosis taken the idea of anarchism. So I think as a political term, as a label, I think it's problematic, and I personally don't, I don't disown it per se, but I don't particularly use that label because I think it puts the emphasis in the wrong place anyway. I think that ultimately what I would like to advocate is based on an ethical principle of voluntarism, i.e. You can do whatever you want. I don't really care as long as it's not going to affect what I'm doing. People are free to make their own choices and make their own failures in life. And I don't feel it's my duty or it's for me to come along and tell you how to live your life any more than it's your duty to come along and tell me how to live my life. So it's more based on the ethical principle than on any sort of political ideology or economic ideology. But so the problem with this ideology, though, is that it as an ethical principle, it doesn't really tell us how to live our lives. A lot of people, when they're looking for some sort of political solution to the crises that we face, they do want some sort of ideology, some nice pat ideology that's going to come along and tell people, here's the system, and if everyone lives in this system, then we'll be all right. Whether that's socialism or the sort of democratic systems that we live in today, or whatever it may be, there's a system in place, and you just live through that, and everything will be okay. The type of anarchism that I envision anyway is not a system, and it doesn't tell you how to live your life. And there could be as many different ways of living your life in that system as there are people on this planet. And I would assume that there would be communities of interest that would gather around, and some of them would be more socialist in nature, and others would be more individualistic in nature, and some would be communitarian in nature, or whatever it may be. There'd be all sorts of different flavors. And again, I wouldn't have any problem with that as long as participation in those systems was voluntary. I don't really care how you decide to organize yourself with others around you, as long as, you know, I have the right to not be a part of it. And so I can't say really what that system would look like, because I think I think it would look very differently all over the globe. And there would be, as I say, there would be communities of interest that would come together, I think, to try to see their vision of what society could be. And ultimately, I think the ideal would be to have lots of different competing ideas, and may the best man win. I mean, it's not necessarily that. It may just be that there can be different people living their lives in different ways that can be equally happy living those lives in different ways. And what's wrong with that? So that's the idea that I would have, rather than some sort of system where it's all going to look the same all across the board. I think there's going to be a lot of different people trying to live in different ways, and it's not in any way a utopia or a utopian vision. There will always be criminals and evil people trying to do evil things. But when there is no big stick of government for those evil people to wield, it's a lot harder for them to really puppeteer global politics in the way that they do today.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, given a chance, mankind can, come up with their own solutions. And like you say, they're going to be multiple solutions from all sectors. So you don't describe yourself as an anarchist or a libertarian so as not to be labeled or whatever. But what would you say to those that claim that there is nothing wrong with the system that we have at the moment, that the failure comes from basically the hand-picked, corruptible, compromised characters that occupy the positions of power and policy as we know it at the moment, and that the removal of this element and the restoration of checks and balances such as the Glass-Steagall Act is what's needed?
Well, I have great sympathy and empathy for those people who think that way. I certainly thought that way for a considerable period of my life, and I understand why it's tempting to think that way, because, of course, the idea and the ideal of having governments is this idea that, well, we have to give up some of our personal freedoms in order to ensure the safety of society and the functioning of this society. And I understand that idea, and I understand why it appeals to so many people. Because, let's face it, a lot of people just don't want to take on the responsibility of being responsible for their own lives. I mean, that's a huge responsibility, and it's much, much simpler and much nicer to think that there's going to be some sort of power that's going to regulate everything in the same way that mother and father regulate the household. Well, here we have mommy and daddy government to come along and tell us how to live our lives, and they'll take care of the bad guys. And I understand that urge, but again, obviously I would say it's somewhat laughable that anarchism, as the type of anarchism that I would advocate, is often derided as, oh, that's utopian and that's too simplistic. Whereas I think, if anything, the utopian system is this idea that somehow you're going to have this body, this agency that has the actual monopoly on the use of force in society over a given geographic region, that is somehow not going to be corrupted, is not going to be turned into what it has demonstrably been turned into. And, I'll believe in the idea that you can have checks and balances and a well-functioning system of government when I see it. I mean, as a lot of people who advocate the sort of minarchist idea would say, I mean, the U.S. was the original sort of founding of the U.S. was the greatest achievement in furthering of human freedom on this planet and all of this. Well, look what it's become. I mean, it has become the biggest instrument of global tyranny that the world has ever seen. So clearly something went wrong there. And I realize that's not a satisfying argument, because people will always say, well, that doesn't prove that it's not possible. Well, again, prove me wrong. I mean, just prove me wrong. I just think it's ridiculous to think that we can at the same time understand and admit that there are evil people acting in nefarious ways to try to expand their control and power and influence and money in the corporate world, but we can't admit that those same people will populate and control the political classes as well. What is the solution to this? Clearly, it is to get rid of that big stick that is the driving force behind the system that we know it. And again, that doesn't solve all the problems. It doesn't get rid of the evil people acting in nefarious ways, but it takes away their main instrument of power. And in a society where all you have is your choice whether or not to, for example, support this or that corporation with your dollars, well, you actually have a direct influence on whether or not those evil people actually do have power over you and your family. And that's not always simple, and it's not always easy, but it is it's the only way that I can think of to escape this system where we're all yoked into supporting these fascists and these horrible people, because, well, you got to pay your taxes. I mean, it's going to a good cause. Some people in need actually get something out of it. Therefore, you've got to pay it, even if it does mean that, a lot of it gets spent on cronies and banksters and people in positions making bombs to drop on people halfway around the world. I mean, that's just the price we got to pay for this kind of wonderful system that we have. Well, I say that's rubbish, and I think that the idea that that sort of system can be reformed into anything other than the gangster monopoly that it is the real utopian thinking.
No, that's right. It's it's time for change, that's for sure. And talking about escaping the system, do you see a massive global change in attitudes rising anytime soon? And how do we avoid the Mad Max scenario, the short-term Mad Max scenario that we're being sort of predictably programmed to expect through movies and the such?
Yeah, well, this is the real question. And I think, do I see this sort of the change that in consciousness that would be needed to actually make a system of freedom, true freedom, actually work? Not in the short term, no. I mean, this is a generational project, and we have been conditioned for generations centuries, millennia perhaps, to expect that the only way that we can actually organize society is through this sort of this government monopoly, whether that was the divine right of kings to rule over us and in the feudal system of hundreds of years ago, or whether it's this democratic system of today, where the voting machines tell us who is the most favored candidate among the pre-selected candidates. We're conditioned into expecting that that's the only way that society can function. How are we going to get ourselves out of that? I mean, that's not the type of thing you just flip a switch and people will magically change and realize that they're being exploited. I hope that they would, but I don't expect that to happen. I think that we have to really, you know, we have to start growing up the next generation to understand from the very beginning of their life that they are free in human beings that do not have to live in this system, that there is another way of organizing our society. So it is a generational project to tear down those walls that have been built up over generations. But as you say, we are being programmed to expect this Mad Max scenario, and of course there's sort of the prepper mentality, which I'm, again, broadly sympathetic to, but unfortunately, again, it also paints the picture that, well, everyone around you is potentially, you know, the people who are going to be fighting to kill and get your food when the rubber meets the road and everything collapses, so you better be prepared to kill them all, is kind of part of that mentality. And I think that, again, obviously that's not the type of society that we want. The only real solution is to start now, while we have the chance, start building up the type of communities that we want to have after the collapse that we are all expecting, even if the collapse doesn't come. There is no bad thing about building up the types of communities that we actually want to live in, where people cooperate and with each other and trade with each other. And yes, of course, I mean, there are going to be neighbors that you don't get along with or whatever, but sure, you can have the choice to not interact with those people and interact with those that you want to. But again, the point is to try to connect with people who actually are part of your community, rather than being welded to this international structure of banking and industrial food production and all of these other things, which make no sense except from the perspective of would-be global controllers who want to centralize everything. So how do we actually avoid this? Again, it's just there's no real substitute for it. It's hard work. It's starting now to participate where and when and how we can. And again, I think people are looking for the sort of silver bullet solution that will change everything overnight, in which they have to do minimal work and will get maximum rewards, of course, because, you know, who wouldn't want that? But I don't think that's going to happen. I think that's, again, naive and simplistic. I think the only thing that we can do is to start participating today in any way that we can. And it may not be revolutionary or may not look revolutionary at first. It could be something as simple as planting something in your back garden rather than growing a bunch of grass that you're never going to do anything other than look at and think, oh, what a pleasant scene. I mean, maybe just growing something that you can actually eat in your own garden can be a revolutionary act. And until we start seeing each and every one of those tiny little decisions that we make each and every day to plant a garden or to go to the farmer's market or to use an alternative local currency or whatever it may be, until we start seeing those types of things as revolutionary acts, I don't think we'll ever quite understand what revolution actually is.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think someone much wiser than me said that there's only two times to plant a tree, and that's 20 years ago and now.
Yeah.
And I think that stands true over the board.
Yeah, absolutely, totally agree with you. James, with so-called conspiracy theories butting their heads against the establishment more and more these days, as we're progressing from the ridicule phase into the violently opposing phase, online censorship, anti-conspiracy theorist legislation, and recently the British Prime Minister likened them to terrorists, etc., How do you feel that under the current UK definitions that you're probably considered to be one of the largest info-terrorists on the planet at the moment?
I think there are bigger info-terrorists than myself, but no, I point taken. And that's an exceptionally important point, isn't it? Because, of course, everything that I have done has been enabled by this connection that we have right now to talk, you know, halfway around the world instantaneously, which, again, I hope that people out there don't take for granted, because it is such an incredible thing that we have at our fingertips right now that really has not existed in human history before. And it really is what we make of it. And that's not to be Pollyanna-ish about it and say just because the internet exists that everything's okay. But it is to say that we do have this incredible potential at our fingertips, literally, that if for relatively little cost, we in the industrialized world, at any rate, can take advantage of and can smash through the systems of propaganda and control that have been erected and have been in place for centuries. So it is an exceptionally important point in human history that we are at right now. And of course, the ruling powers that shouldn't be do not want the type of freedom that we have right now. I don't think that they want to shut down the internet entirely or the idea, because I think that ultimately this is part of the plan to get everyone online in terms of in their databases and surveilled all the time, because we gladly, lovingly buy all of this surveillance tech porn that they put out and make glossy and look so good for all of us. Oh, the latest I Fondles Lab, I must have it. So of course, I mean, I think that's part of their plan. So I don't think they want to shut it down entirely, but of course they do want to clamp down on the type of free speech we have. And you're exactly right. And online censorship and legislation and arresting people for tweeting now in Britain, or at least in investigating people for various tweets that they've made and all this type of stuff. We had Joe Lieberman come out a few years ago and say, we need a Chinese-style internet censorship in the U.S. We need a presidential kill switch for the internet and all of these crazy things that are being talked about. And of course, what was the biggest story of the end of 2014 was the Sony hack story, which is probably the most spectacular false flag hacking event that we've seen so far, where the FBI and the U.S. government was all too quick to blame it on North Korea until a lot of tech experts stepped in and said there's absolutely no reason for saying that North Korea did this. In fact, it was almost certainly an inside job from someone who worked or works for Sony. So again, I think we understand that in this age where everything takes place online and everything is virtual, we are entering a system where all the government has to do is say, look, terrorists are using the internet to do X, Y, or Z, so now we're going to stop you from doing X, Y, or Z. And that's the way that that could happen. But I think the even more insidious part of this censorship agenda is the sort of centralization of people online into a few sort of outlets that are obviously in the pockets of the globalists, the Googles, the YouTubes, the Facebooks, whatever, where people tend to centralize and which are undoubtedly the biggest sites on the internet. And you look at something like a YouTube, which of course part of the forerunner of that was Google Video, which back in the day when I first started getting into this, I remember Google Video had a top 100 videos section, and I'd go to check that on a daily basis, and it would consistently be in the top 10. You would have A Loose Change or documentaries like that, Terror Storm, or those types of things, which would, I mean, truth, quote unquote, truth movement type of material would consistently be in the top 10, if not number one, every single day of the week. And so I saw them start to manipulate the algorithm, so that started to change, and then they started to make the top 100 videos harder to find on the Google Video page, and then they got rid of Google Video altogether, but you still had YouTube, which still had a front page where they would sort of trending videos would go, but then they started to remove that, and now you have this system where basically everyone sees a front page that's tailored to their interests. So I'll see a lot of stuff related to, you know, again, quote unquote, truth kind of material, but but most people won't. And just as one tiny reflection on that, I had a video a couple of years ago that was literally, it was just me and my wife had gone out for a picnic in the park. So I decided to record a little video just plugging an excellent documentary I had watched called Children Full of Life. And I wanted everyone to see this documentary. So I thought, oh, I'll just record a little plug for that. So I did this 90-second video or 2-minute video just saying, hey guys, this is an excellent video, go check it out. And for some reason or other, that made its way to the front page of YouTube and got something like 300,000 views, and is still in, I think, my top 10 most viewed videos, or somewhere up there. And all because it just, for whatever reason, trended in the right way and got to the front page of YouTube. That doesn't exist anymore. I mean, that will never happen to any of my videos again. And so there is a difference that's being made right now. And it's in the way that these types of sites are being engineered to try to filter out content that's going to make a difference. And of course, I mean, I don't use Facebook, but people who do tell me that it's been engineered for quite a long time to make sure that only certain types of stories will show up in your feeds, or you can't post stories from certain sites, and that type of thing is going to become more and more important. So even if they don't clamp down with the kill switch or anything of that sort, even if it's not a Chinese style, they will not let you search certain keywords type systems. At any rate, the sites themselves can be engineered in a way that will make it less and less likely that people will ever see or hear this type of information. And I think that's really perhaps the danger, because again, we're being sold on the beauty and the wonders that the internet can provide. But if it's just to basically put us in their databases and get us tracked and controlled and surveilled, then everything is for naught.
Absolutely. Yeah,
that's right. It's a double-edged sword, the internet. do you feel the alternative media are making progress fast enough to expose the system, are we reaching that important tipping point?
I would love to think so. obviously, I do see from my own perspective, even in just the way that my own site and my own work has taken off in the 7 years, 7.5 years I've been doing this now, I do see that it is having an effect. And it is, I mean, there are more and more people who are getting interested in this information. And that's reflected in everything that I do. I mean, when I started 7.5 years ago, it was still one of the most sort of revolutionary things I could think of would be to say, 9/11 was an inside job. Now, that is not really such an outrageous statement to a lot of people. Most people have at least been exposed to that idea, if not are sympathetic to it. There is an appreciable change that has happened in the last several years, and more and more people are waking up. Is it fast enough to counteract the types of things what we're talking about? Again, that's the proof's going to be in the pudding with that one. And all I know is that the more people who are exposed to this information before whatever happens, the more we will have on our side when the rubber meets the road. And I don't know if this is going to be enough, but all I do know is if we don't try, if we don't make something of what we have at our disposal right now, then we are going to lose. So obviously, I think there is a chance for us to do something important here, if not to win for all time and defeat the globalists and live happily ever after. At any rate, we can do something to counteract this agenda and steer more people onto the idea of real freedom and liberty. And if we can accomplish even that much, then we've done something. So again, is it enough? Only time will tell on that. But we have to do what we can and let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, we will see. On a more personal note, as your recent father, I don't know if you've seen the reports in the UK press where they're starting to ask nursery employees to report on toddlers, sort of age 2 to 3, for showing extremist behavior. However, how on earth they can do that? But as a father, do you ever worry about raising a child that is geopolitically awake, into this world where this behavior is being targeted and demonized? Are you worried about waking your offspring up too much so that it gets them in trouble? I know this is a concern of mine.
That's an interesting way of putting it, actually, because my concern would be the exact opposite. My concern would be not waking him up enough to understand what's going on. I certainly, yeah. I mean, if the alternatives are to expose my son to reality and truth and have him perhaps, yeah, come into butt heads with power and authority, or to keep him asleep in the Matrix and live a life as a good, serviceable cattle for the tax rulers of all of us. Yeah, I don't think there's any question there which side is better in that equation. I mean, yes, it's not going to be a pleasant or happy experience as he does run up against the system, but again, it's not pleasant or happy for any of us to confront this, and I think we all have to in our own way. Again, I'm not going to tell my son how to live his life or what to do per se. I mean, that's going to be up to him and what he ultimately ends up choosing, but I am going to expose him to reality, and I'm definitely not going to hide anything from him or play Pollyanna about it, just so that in the hopes that he might slip through the cracks of the system, whatever that means, because again, if we're not opposing this system, if we're not actually doing something about it, then how is it ever going to change? Then all that would mean is that he lives his life as a good, serviceable tax slave, and then he brings up his children in that tradition. So I certainly don't want that to be my legacy on this planet, and I can't imagine that anyone who is awake would want that to be their legacy either.
Absolutely.
Totally agree. Keeping things close to home, James, some people are of the opinion that Fukushima is grossly exaggerated and intentionally misleading. With so many false flags and events in present times, who wouldn't question some of the validity of Fukushima and what were being fed through the news? What are the latest facts of the situation at Fukushima at the moment?
The latest, of course, is that, as people may have heard in the last few days, the latest results from tracing the Fukushima radiation plume from the across the Pacific have come in and have confirmed that radiation has reached the west coast of North America. Of course, they're saying it's not at levels that are of concern for human health at this point. But again, people can take that for what it's worth. But there are a number of different organizations and groups that are trying to track this. For example, our radioactiveocean.org is an independent and crowdfunded group that it has ties to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute that's trying to track some of the radiation and things of that nature. So people can at least have some sort of, at least take a look at the data for themselves and come to their own conclusions. But recently, the Japanese government again had to revise their ultimate radiation release estimates for Fukushima, as they have done several times now, to say, oops, you know, actually it was more than we had initially estimated. Again, they've done that several times now, so take their pronouncements for what they're worth, which is absolutely nothing. Unfortunately, there's no simple answer to this other than to say, yes, I mean, a significant amount of radiation was released, and a lot of that went into the ocean, and some of that radiation has now 100% definitively been confirmed to be on the west coast of the United States. And I think people will have to check their own sources of information, check things like the safecast.org map network to try to find out the readings that various people are having right now, and come to their own conclusions about what that means, about the way that they can protect themselves and their family.
And what is the general feeling in Japan? Are people becoming desensitized to the news output from government sources, etc.?
More or less, I would say. I mean, it's difficult to generalize the population, but I think the sort of mainstream response would be that, yes, of course, it's still something that is still in the news from time to time, but obviously not with the type of coverage that we saw in the immediate wake of the disaster. And people here are more generally interested in sort of the economy and things of that note than they are, I think, of what's happening in Fukushima at this point. So if the mission was to simply get that out of the public consciousness, then mostly mission accomplished. There was, I think, a significant anti-nuclear movement that really was gaining steam here for the first couple of years after the disaster. But it's not so politically important here anymore, and it's not having much of an effect on anything. We're still yet to see the restarting of the reactors, which was supposedly going to start last year, but that was delayed. So we'll see if it happens this year, and if so, then perhaps it's just going to return to business as usual for the nuclear industry here.
Wow, crazy, isn't it? Crazy. And after a recent UK court case involving the barrister Michael Shrimpton, which is currently going to appeal here in the UK, he maintains that the tsunami of March 2011 was actually a nuclear detonation off the coast of Japan. Do you think there's any substance to this claim? And if so, would a court case of this nature be a global game changer if the truth came out?
Well, I haven't seen any substance to that claim. I haven't seen anything that would substantiate that. I've certainly heard the theory. I've looked into various proponents of it. But all I've seen is a lot of pieces of a puzzle that don't really add up to me, including the people who claim that it wasn't a 9.0 earthquake. It was a 7 or a 6.5 or whatever people claim. And a lot of that's because of the confusion that's involved with the Japanese scale versus the Richter scale or whatever, the moment magnitude scale or whatever they use these days. So there's a lot of confusion that goes on there that I think added to the sort of problems of some of the citizen reporting. And then there's other claims about Japan, for example, offering to process some of the nuclear fuel for the Iranian nuclear reactors. So they were targeted by Israel, and this was supposedly confirmed by the fact that Stuxnet had been found in Japan and so could have been part of what happened at Fukushima. But in fact, if you actually look into that claim, you find that Stuxnet was found not only all over the globe, but was found much more prominently in a lot of other countries than Japan. I mean, I think Japan was almost at the bottom of the list in terms of how many computer systems were actually affected by Stuxnet. So again, I think there isn't a lot of substance that I've seen to that claim. The most interesting claim that I've seen is the people who were talking about HAARP and HAARP systems in the immediate wake of that actually did have a scientific paper on their side insofar as this was something I pointed out in my podcast on Fukushima. What caused the earthquake, I think was the name of the episode, something like that, where it was a scientific paper that found that there was increased auroral activity directly preceding the earthquake itself. So they found some ionospheric heating that was directly before the earthquake, which they were trying to speculate about. Well, what, you know, now scientists are basically wondering, well, what can this mean? Can this be a way of predicting earthquakes? Of course, the HAARP proponents would say, well, no, it was HAARP that was heating the ionosphere, which caused the earthquake. So there is at least some scientific merit to that claim, and something that I think would merit further investigation. And I think that's probably the most interesting alternative theory from my point of view.
Again, I suppose we live in such sort of confusing times that it's very easy for people to start clutching at straws and creating sort of all sorts of conspiracy theories off the back of these sort of events, really, isn't it?
Basically, yes. And again, I don't necessarily blame people for doing that. Again, I always think that it is probably healthy that our default position is to be skeptical of any particular official story and to be, you know, convinced one way or the other by facts and evidence. But again, that doesn't mean that every single alternative theory that comes along should be taken, you know, wholesale without a grain of salt as well. I mean, we should be equally skeptical about alternative theories as we are about official theories. And again, it should be evidence and facts and data that sway us one way or another.
Yeah. Do you think people understand the true meaning of what a false flag is? I mean, after the recent events in Sydney, you know, there was a lot of people on Twitter and that were very quick to call it a false flag and identify it as one. But this was before anyone was killed. As soon as people seem to be allegedly killed, it was largely held that it couldn't have been a false flag. Ergo, just because people died doesn't make it any less of a false flag, does it? In terms of 7/7, 9/11. Anything else? What do you think about that?
Yes, unfortunately, like everything else, when an idea or a theory or some sort of way of looking at the world becomes popularized, it loses some of its meaning, I think, as it gets translated into sort of mainstream. And unfortunately, false flag is perhaps something of a victim of that, because to one extent, I mean, it's a victory on our part that unlike 10 years ago, now false flag terrorism is part of the popular discourse and is something that most people have heard of. which, again, 10 years ago, most people, if you tried to tell them something like 9/11 inside job, they would look at you funny and say, well, why would the government attack itself? At least now we've sort of penetrated that wall of ignorance and have moved on to the next, which is this confusion now that comes out about these types of events. Of course, there is the tendency to just say everything is a false flag, and if people die, then it means it wasn't a false flag. That doesn't really make any sense. I think we have to keep in mind that false flag itself is a metaphor that comes from naval warfare, where you would have ships that would run up a flag other than their battle flag as a way of trying to deceive their enemies into thinking that it wasn't an attack, or it wasn't an attack by that particular force. So you, for example, I mean, you'd have, I don't know, you'd have the British run up a Spanish flag against the French, I don't know, something like that, and in order to try to trick them into thinking it was the Spanish attacking. So that's where the metaphor comes from, and obviously it's been applied, it's been extended out just to the idea of any type of operation, intelligence or military operation that is designed to make it look like a certain person is attacking when in fact it is someone else. And basically as an excuse to demonize your political opponents. So that's really all that means. And so when we start applying it in the ways that I think it's applied these days, I think it starts to lose some of its meaning as a metaphor. I think that perhaps what people are looking for when they're thinking of something like that Sydney siege situation, perhaps they're thinking it's a hoax, and that's a different type of operation altogether, in which I guess you would have actors playing the parts of the terrorists and victims and all of this, and nothing really happened in the hoax kind of way of looking at things. Nothing actually happened. It was just sort of like a Hollywood movie or something that's being portrayed as real news. So there's that idea is gaining popularity now. But again, I think there's just this tendency to conflate everything and call it a false flag, or to take every false flag operation and call it Gladio B or that type of thing. Again, unfortunately, as this information gets more widely spread, it doesn't necessarily get correctly applied, and some of the actual meaning of these terms gets lost in the equation.
Absolutely. It seems to be largely about manipulating the news and sort of like misleading people of what's really going on. And kind of on that same sort of line, I mean, what do you consider the principal reasons for the plummeting oil prices at present? Is this just a direct attack on the Russian economy? Is this potentially a way of making fracking non-viable? As hopeful as that sounds, then it does make you wonder what the agenda would be there. Or is there further agendas with regards to this? If oil is no longer the top dog, could we be looking at an alternative, a free energy of some description? Or indeed something else?
Well, I think this is really the key geopolitical event of early 2015, and we'll have to see what comes of this, but I think it has so many ramifications. I mean, as you're saying, it makes fracking at the prices that oil is at now, and especially in the trend going downwards from here, it does take fracking off the table as a viable way of extracting oil and gas. It does change so many geopolitical relations. It changes the equations for Europe and whether they can subvert the sort of Russian necessity of keeping that Russian lifeline, and all sorts of different things come into play. And it really does make you wonder sort of what is ultimately behind this. And it's been widely reported, even in the mainstream, in The Guardian and elsewhere, that there was a quote-unquote secret arrangement that obviously wasn't so secret that was hit on between Saudi Arabia and John Kerry, representing this the State Department of the U.S. at the time, to basically get the Saudis pumping as much oil as possible to undermine primarily Russia, but also, of course, I mean, Venezuela and Iran and any number of other American State Department nominal enemies. So there, that was the sort of, that's basically the way in which this has been put forward. But I think that perhaps the more interesting idea is that really the only, I think, clear cut, undeniable winners in this are the extremely energy hungry energy importers. And who is the number one in the world? That would be China. And that, to me, plays into a very interesting narrative that I've been noting over the past couple of years, in which Saudi Arabia has been moving more and more, or edging towards the exit of the orbit of the United States in the petrodollar sort of system that's been in place for a long time, and edging towards China and its relationship with China, which would make every economic sense for Saudi Arabia. I mean, China is the largest oil importer in the world now, and obviously Saudi Arabia knows which side its bread is buttered on. The only reason the Saudi royals are in power is because of the oil, the oligarchy, of course, that has been in charge of that country for a very long time. So I think that ultimately the clear-cut winner of this is China, and that is interesting in this sort of, as I call it, the 2D chess game of the nation states vying against each other. That clearly puts sort of more power in the hands of China, who is very energy hungry at this time, and takes some of that power out of American hands, because not only does it sort of undermine the U.S. petrodollar, but it also undermines the Saudi Arabian American sort of domination of the Middle East that has been in place for more than half a century. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting things that will develop out of this, and we'll have to see if this trend continues. But if it does, I think China is ultimately going to walk away as the winners in this.
Absolutely. And well, and also with so much of the sort of like the global economy being pinned on oil, do you see that there's any correlation maybe between the disruption in global economy and the recent G20 meeting and the announcement of confirming bank bail-ins, that we could be looking at an asset grab in many respects, as depositors are much more risk now than ever before?
Yes, well, I don't know if there's a causal relationship there, but certainly that is one of the effects that this is going to have. There are obviously a lot of banks that are heavily exposed with derivatives in the oil markets that are going to be taking a big hit, and it certainly could come about, as I recently talked about with Ellen Brown, that will eventuate into another banking crisis that will this time not be dealt with primarily with bank bailouts, but with bank bail-ins, so Cyprus-style confiscation of people's deposits and pensions and the like in order to bail in the banksters. That's certainly a possibility and something that we'll have to be very, very wary of. And another good reason, if any were needed, to keep our money out of the bank, the banks of these big connected globalist institutions and in credit unions and the like that aren't involved so much in the derivatives markets. So certainly that's going to play a part in all of this. And I think another aspect of what's going on, it's not just Saudi Arabia pumping that's causing the oil prices to fall. I mean, we can see that there's a fall in commodity classes all across the board. We are seeing a sort of deflationary cycle right now. And there are, I mean, the only debate is between those people who think that this is going to be a long-term deflationary depression, or those who are saying that this is just the prelude to the hyperinflationary cycle that will come after this. And again, that's still up in the air, but either way, it's not going to be particularly pretty for most of us down in the bottom rungs of this economic ladder.
Well, James, that was one of the fastest hours I've ever experienced. Are you okay for another couple of questions?
Let's hit them up. Let's go.
Okay, just
Okay. Let's quickly go on to a more controversial one at the moment, then, James. White genocide. This is a subject matter that's getting more and more airtime these days. Being a white Canadian expat living in Japan with a Japanese family. What's your personal slant on this seemingly suppressed subject of the white race is being targeted for genocide?
Well, I think I would need more elaboration on what that actually means.
It's largely on the basis of the white existence on the planet is reducing, and that it's actually being targeted by immigration and government policies to reduce the extent of the white populations in various countries. I think mainly in the northern hemispheres, obviously, looking at Europe, Sweden being a hotbed for this. It seems to be a subject matter which is coming up in the headlines more and more these days, yet it kind of flirts with divisive sort of language and potential sort of like race hate in some areas as well. Is it something you've got an opinion on at all, or is it something you've researched?
Yeah, well, it certainly does strike me that it does bring with it a lot of the sort of race hatred and trying to keep people divided and conquered and fighting at the bottom of the economic power pyramid once again. Because ultimately, again, as a voluntarist, I don't care who people marry or who people fall in love with or who people have kids with. Obviously, as someone who has lived in Japan for 10 years now with a Japanese wife and a half Japanese son, I'm not particularly sympathetic to the idea of some sort of racial superiority of any particular race over another. As my friend Larry Pinkney of the original Black Panther Party puts it, there's only one race, it's the human race. And the only real division is between those of us at the bottom of this power pyramid who are being ruled over by those at the very top. And nothing else really of that sort matters to me. I mean, again, if people want to only marry among their own race and only have children of pure white heritage or whatever, you know, go for it. I don't care. But as long as they're not telling me who I can or cannot marry, because obviously I married a Japanese woman and have a lovely half-Japanese son. So this is not a particular preoccupation of mine. I think that so much of this is targeted at stirring up that racial hatred and which has always been, and I'm sure will continue to be, an excellent source of divide and conquer for the would-be rulers, as we are seeing playing out spectacularly in the United States right now, where obviously it's a very touch button issue. And I understand, you know, why people get caught up in that and how they get caught up in it. But I would prefer people to think about not the people around them who they see on a daily basis, but the people who are literally, I mean, not just billionaires, not just trillionaires, but people who literally create the money out of nothing, play games with this world like it's their little toy, and puppeteer us all around by, you know, creating these spectacular news events and staging 9/11 and things like this. That's the real enemy. It's not the person that you saw today who, you know, whatever. I mean, even the people who are looting or stealing at the bottom of this. Yeah, I understand. You got to protect yourself and your family, and I have no problem with that. But at the end of the day, the real battle is between the people who've created this entire system, the entire society, the world that we see around us. And that's not the sort of, you know, racial games that they're trying to get us to play here. I think it's a much, much deeper issue, and it goes much more towards the fundamental power structure of society than that.
Certainly. But I mean, there is a difference in wanting to preserve a nation's regions and culture and traditions and so forth, and then also versus wanting to preserve a race's blood and purity. I've heard of these two causes being wrapped into the one cause. And do you think people should maybe be more aware of this? Japan's been very steeped in its own traditions and so forth. Do you see any sort of like play like that in Japan itself?
Right. No, I mean, clearly there's a huge base for that sort of, well, racial superiority type thinking is quite popular here as well, because obviously this is a very isolated culture that for thousands of years was almost completely isolated from the rest of the world. So clearly there is that element here, and that will always play well. And there is that sort of, you know, racial superiority thinking that still remains from the imperial days, where Japan was an imperial power that had colonies throughout East Asia, and they still think of themselves as sort of the top of the food chain in Asia. So I think there's definitely that element to it, and that's one of the reasons that Japan still continues to be 98%, I believe, ethnically homogeneous. Homogeneous. I cannot say that word for the life of me. People know what I mean. 98% Japanese. So it's going to be an extremely difficult process for them to open up, as they will need to do in order to stave off this population decline that is demographically baked into the cake. I mean, a greater percentage of 100-plus-year-olds here than anywhere else on the world, which speaks to some extent to the healthiness, I think, ultimately, of Japanese lifestyle. But unfortunately, the declining birth rates also speak to the other side of that, which is a culture in decline. So yes, I mean, that plays very well here in Japan. Ultimately, once again, I understand people's sort of feeling that they want to preserve the sort of cultural heritage of a certain place, etc. But again, as a voluntarist, borders are just lines on a map drawn in some boardroom, generally by some, you know, would-be world ruler or dictator. I mean, that's especially apparent in places like Syria or whatever, which were literally creations of the First World War that have no relevance in the real world and obviously are just being held together either by dictators or are being split apart at the seams by terrorists, bloodletters. I mean, talking about setting up to fail, that's a perfect example of it. And I think these arbitrary lines on maps and telling people that they can live here, but they can't live there, or you can't cross this line on this map without this document from this government being, you know, your pass to go from here to there, is ridiculous. I think if people were left literally to, without borders, without lines, without maps, were left to be in communities, then I think, yeah, you would have communities coming together that held certain cultural traditions and values, and you would not have people traveling, you know, halfway around the globe, because, again, there would be no comparative advantage to living in one arbitrary place than another, other than whatever was, I suppose, naturally there, or whatever benefits a certain cultural heritage or cultural tradition could bring in terms of perhaps economic output or whatever. But again, that would be a process of people coming to that place because they were drawn to those traditions per se, rather than because, again, they're economic refugees from a system that, again, has been created by people in boardrooms and drawing rooms halfway around the world. So, again, I think there's a bigger system at play. And I think that that ultimately, again, as a voluntarist, if people want to preserve a certain way of life or a certain tradition, then absolutely do so voluntarily with those around you. But don't tell other people how to live.
Yeah, no, I think we agree on that one. It's important to differentiate between the preservation of regions, cultures, and traditions and ways of life, and not to wrap it up with this race purity and blood purity, which seems to be happening in Europe at the moment, or the narrative is anyway. Well, we're knocking on a bit now, so we'll look to wrap this up. What's front and center on James Corbett's radar this year, then? What is it that you're researching?
I am going to be concentrating more and more this year on solutions. And I've always prided myself on being an alternative media outlet that is more solutions focused than I think a lot of the other that are more, I think, more geared towards the fear porn side of the equation. But I want to step that up even more this year, because the more I get into this and the longer that I do this, the more that I see that all of these events that flit across the radar, the news radar, are really, in some ways, if they are not actually designed to do so, they at least have the effect of doing so, of making the alternative media focus on them as if that is the only thing that matters in the world for whatever length of time, however many days or weeks that story lasts, and then move on to the next thing. So, for example, the Sydney siege. Again, I could have done 18 reports on that and had all sorts of coverage and speculated about, you know, which or group or another was puppeteering that, or was it a hoax, or was it a false flag, or, you know, all of that sort of thing. But ultimately, what does that get us? Where does that get us? It gets us into the situation of constantly just reacting to the events that are being created at the top. And I think that's completely the wrong way to approach this. We have to start eschewing the 24/7 news media and the events that they want us to concentrate on, and focusing more on what we can actually do in our own daily lives, what we can actually accomplish. And that doesn't mean that we have to completely 100% ignore what's going on in the world, but it means that we keep one eye on what's going on out there and one eye on what we're actually doing and accomplishing for ourselves. And as we start to steer that news agenda away from what they want us to concentrate on and more into what we actually want to build up as the alternative, I think more people will be attracted to what we are doing. Because ultimately, if our message is simply everything's a hoax and don't believe them and they're all liars and murderers and everything's going to hell, there's a certain segment of the population, at any rate, that are going to be turned off by that message, and I couldn't blame them for that. So I want the Corbett Report to really be a beacon for people who are looking for ideas about what they can actually do and accomplish, rather than just focusing on what's being done to them. So I hope that yourself and others out there will be interested in that as I start steering the ship in that direction.
Yep, absolutely. And I noticed the what you've coined, open source intelligence, is what's running on Corbett Report at the moment. What is that, and how can people get involved?
Open source intelligence is basically the idea that it was actually, I think, first, I'm not sure first coined, but at least first really implemented by the CIA, who actually set up an open source intelligence office, which is basically just the idea that the most valuable information and most of the valuable information that's available out there in the world today is not to be found by James Bond style sleuthing behind enemy lines or anything of that sort. Nothing quite so glamorous. Most of the information that we need to form an understanding of what's happening in the world today is freely and openly available through open sources like newspapers or televisions or, in this day and age, the internet. And so basically, this is the idea that we can basically form our own intelligence agencies, if you want to think of it that way, simply by combining, obviously I can't do it myself, no one out there can do it by themselves, but by combining hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, millions of people around the world who each have their own specialties and interests and abilities, and combining all of that knowledge and harnessing it, sort of crowdsourcing that knowledge, we can actually create a pretty accurate map of the terrain of what's happening in the world today. So one example of that, which I pointed out recently in a talk that I gave in Groningen in the Netherlands, is the idea of MH17. Again, thousands of Corbett Report members all around the world in different languages, sourcing all these different videos and interviews and things like this, bringing it into a report that I was working on through the comment section of CorbettReport.com. And then I got a dozen or so of the Corbett Report members to take that information and condense it down into a presentation. I delivered that presentation as a podcast. It now has over 500,000 views online. That's something. That's a different conception of the way that we can actually start constructing a vision of the world. It's not perfect and it's not fully functioning yet, but I hope to further that on Corbett Report in the coming weeks and months and years. And probably the next open source intelligence report that we're going to be working on is going to involve the pedophile scandals, which was once again in the news with Jeffrey Epstein? Oh, I don't want to say the wrong name. Anyway, that person who the billionaire in the United States who got ensnared and apparently has links to Prince Andrew and Bill Clinton and others. And that scandal is slowly unraveling. I want to use that as a basis for examining the sort of pedophile rings that operate at the highest levels in general. So I'm going to start crowdsourcing the knowledge on that and seeing what we can come up with for a future report. So if people want to get involved with that, they can go to CorbettReport.com. If you want to actually leave comments and be part of that conversation, you can become a member of the website, and that's for as little as 100 Japanese yen a month, which is less than $1 a month, less than 1 euro a month at this point, I believe, because the yen is almost nothing, it's toilet paper. So so for less than $12 a year, people can become a part of this this open source journalism that's going on at CorbettReport.com. or, you know, why not start your own site, start your own podcast like the Yeoman Trust or whatever it may be, and get your own idea out there. And I'm 100% on board with that as well.
Well, I look forward to the open source intelligence on the pedophile scandals because it's rife over here in the UK, and I think I'll be contributing to that. But open source intelligence definitely seems to be the way forward. I think you're pioneering it brilliantly. I think, yeah, in terms of becoming a member of Corbett Report, I think I tweeted a couple of weeks ago when I became a member that it was less than a cost of an apple, so a month. So
I think I'm going to steal that one. Thank you for that idea. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, well, James, that's been an incredibly fast interview from this end. I really appreciate your time. You've made yourself available to Joe Bloggs, basically us, and we really appreciate that. And anyone who's interested can go and find your work on the CorbettReport.com. Anything else?
No, because just recommend anybody that hasn't been to the website yet go and have a look. It's fascinating. It's an absolute minefield of information.
And I think this is around about the time where we mug you and say we hope to see you. We hope to get you back on the show at some point.
Anytime you need me, I'm always happy to see new people joining the fray and getting their voices out there. So my hat's off to you guys for doing what you're doing, and let's continue forward together.
Absolutely. Thanks. Many thanks for your time, and have a good day.
Thank you.
Take care. Cheers. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.